Chapter 14. The Unforgivable Curses. The next 2 days passed without great incident, unless you counted Neville melting his sixth cauldron in potions. Professor Snape, who seemed to have attained new levels of vindictiveness over the summer, gave Neville detention, and Neville returned from it in a state of nervous collapse, having been made to disembowel a barrelful of horned toads. "You know why Snape's in such a foul mood, don't you?" said Ron to Harry, as they watched Hermione teaching Neville a scouring charm to remove the frog guts from under his fingernails. "Yeah," said Harry, "moody." It was common knowledge that Snape really wanted the dark arts job, and he had now failed to get it for the fourth year running. Snape had disliked all of their previous dark arts teachers and shown it, but he seemed strangely wary of displaying overt animosity to Mad-Eye Moody. Indeed, whenever Harry saw the two of them together, at mealtimes or when they passed in the corridors, he had the distinct impression that Snape was avoiding Moody's eye, whether magical or normal. "I reckon Snape's a bit scared of him, you know," Harry said thoughtfully. "Imagine if Moody turned Snape into a horned toad," said Ron, his eyes misting over, "and bounced him all around his dungeon." The Gryffindor fourth years were looking forward to Moody's first lesson so much that they arrived early after lunch on Thursday and queued up outside his classroom before the bell had even rung. The only person missing was Hermione, who turned up just in time for the lesson. "Been in the library," Harry finished her sentence for her. "Come on, quick, or we won't get decent seats." They hurried into three chairs right in front of the teacher's desk, took out their copies of The Dark Forces, A Guide to Self-Protection, and waited, unusually quiet. Soon they heard Moody's distinctive clunking footsteps coming down the corridor, and he entered the room, looking as strange and frightening as ever. They could just see his clawed wooden foot protruding from underneath his robes.
"You can put those away,"
he growled, stumping over to his desk and sitting down.
"Those books, you won't need them."
They returned the books to their bags, Ron looking excited. Moody took out a register, shook his long mane of grizzled grey hair out of his twisted and scarred face, and began to call out names, his normal eye moving steadily down the list, while his magical eye swiveled around, fixing upon each student as he or she answered.
"Right, then,"
he said, when the last person had declared themselves present.
"I've had a letter from Professor Lupin about this class. Seems you've had a pretty thorough grounding in tackling dark creatures. You've covered boggarts, redcaps, hinky punks, grindelows, cappers and werewolves. Is that right?"
There was a general murmur of assent.
"But you're behind, very behind, on dealing with curses," said Moody. "So I'm here to bring you up to scratch on what wizards can do to each other. I've got 1 year to teach you how to deal with dark..."
"What, aren't you staying?" Ron blurted out.
Moody's magical eye spun around to stare at Ron. Ron looked extremely apprehensive, but after a moment Moody smiled, the first time Harry had seen him do so. The effect was to make his heavily scarred face look more twisted and contorted than ever, but it was nevertheless a relief to know that he ever did anything as friendly as smile. Ron looked deeply relieved.
"You'll be Arthur Weasley's son, eh?"
Moody said.
"Your father got me out of a very tight corner a few days ago. Yeah, I'm staying just the 1 year. Special favour to Dumbledore. 1 year, and then back to my quiet retirement. Ha!"
He gave a harsh laugh, and then clapped his gnarled hands together.
"So, straight into it, curses. They come in many strengths and forms. Now, according to the Ministry of Magic, I'm supposed to teach you counter-curses and leave it at that. I'm not supposed to show you what illegal dark curses look like until you're in the sixth year. You're not supposed to be old enough to deal with it till then. But Professor Dumbledore's got a higher opinion of your nerves. He reckons you can cope. And I say, the sooner you know what you're up against, the better. How are you supposed to defend yourself against something you've never seen? A wizard who's about to put an illegal curse on you isn't going to tell you what he's about to do. He's not going to do it nice and polite to your face. You need to be prepared. You need to be alert and watchful. You need to put that away, Miss Brown, when I'm talking."
Lavender jumped and blushed. She had been showing Parvati her completed horoscope under the desk. Apparently, Moody's magical eye could see through solid wood as well as out of the back of his head.
"So, do any of you know which curses are most heavily punished by wizarding law?"
Several hands rose tentatively into the air, including Ron's and Hermione's. Moody pointed at Ron, though his magical eye was still fixed on Lavender.
Said Ron tentatively. "My dad told me about one. Is it called the Imperious Curse or something?"
"Ah, yes," said Moody appreciatively. "Your father would know that one. Gave the Ministry a lot of trouble at one time, the Imperious Curse."
Moody got heavily to his mismatched feet, opened his desk drawer, and took out a glass jar. Three large black spiders were scuttling around inside it. Harry felt Ron recoil slightly next to him. Ron hated spiders. Moody reached into the jar, caught one of the spiders, and held it in the palm of his hand so that they could all see it. He then pointed his wand at it and muttered,
"Imperio."
The spider leapt from Moody's hand on a fine thread of silk and began to swing backwards and forwards as though on a trapeze. It stretched out its legs rigidly, then did a backflip, breaking the thread and landing on the desk, where it began to cartwheel in circles. Moody jerked his wand, and the spider rose onto two of its hind legs and went into what was unmistakably a tap dance. Everyone was laughing. Everyone except Moody.
"Think it's funny, do you?" he growled. "You'd like it, would you, if I did it to you?"
The laughter died away almost instantly.
"Total control," said Moody quietly,
as the spider balled itself up and began to roll over and over.
"I could make it jump out of the window, drown itself, throw itself down one of your throats."
Ron gave an involuntary shudder.
"Years back, there were a lot of witches and wizards being controlled by the Imperious Curse," said Moody,
and Harry knew he was talking about the days in which Voldemort had been all-powerful.
"Some job for the Ministry, trying to sort out who was being forced to act and who was acting of their own free will. The Imperious Curse can be fought, and I'll be teaching you how, but it takes real strength of character, and not everyone's got it. Better avoid being hit with it if you can. Constant vigilance!" he barked, and everyone jumped.
Moody picked up the somersaulting spider and threw it back into the jar.
"Anyone else know one? Another illegal curse?"
Hermione's hand flew into the air again, and so, to Harry's slight surprise, did Neville's. The only class in which Neville usually volunteered information was herbology, which was easily his best subject. Neville looked surprised at his own daring.
"Yes?"
said Moody, his magical eye rolling right over to fix on Neville.
"There's one, the Cruciatus Curse," said Neville, in a small but distinct voice.
Moody was looking very intently at Neville, this time with both eyes.
"Your name's Longbottom," he said,
his magical eyes swooping down to check the register again. Neville nodded nervously, but Moody made no further inquiries. Turning back to the class at large, he reached into the jar for the next spider and placed it upon the desktop, where it remained motionless, apparently too scared to move.
"The Cruciatus Curse," said Moody. "Needs to be a bit bigger for you to get the idea," he said,
pointing his wand at the spider.
"Engorgio."
The spider swelled. It was now larger than a tarantula. Abandoning all pretense, Ron pushed his chair backwards as far away from Moody's desk as possible. Moody raised his wand again, pointed it at the spider, and muttered,
"Crucio."
At once, the spider's legs bent in upon its body. It rolled over and began to twitch horribly, rocking from side to side. No sound came from it, but Harry was sure that if it could have given voice, it would have been screaming. Moody did not remove his wand, and the spider started to shudder and jerk more violently.
"Stop it!"
Hermione said shrilly.
Harry looked around at her. She was looking not at the spider, but at Neville, and Harry, following her gaze, saw that Neville's hands were clenched upon the desk in front of him, his knuckles white, his eyes wide and horrified. Moody raised his wand. The spider's legs relaxed, but it continued to twitch.
"Reducio,"
Moody muttered, and the spider shrank back to its proper size. He put it back into the jar.
"Pain," said Moody softly. "You don't need thumbscrews or knives to torture someone if you can perform the Cruciatus curse. That one was very popular once, too. Right. Anyone know any others?"
Harry looked around. From the looks on everyone's faces, he guessed they were all wondering what was going to happen to the last spider. Hermione's hand shook slightly as, for the third time, she raised it into the air.
"Yes?"
said Moody, looking at her. "Avada Kedavra," Hermione whispered. Several people looked uneasily around at her, including Ron.
"Ah," said Moody, another slight smile twisting his lopsided mouth. "Yes, the last and worst. Avada Kedavra, the killing curse."
He put his hand into the glass jar, and almost as though he knew what was coming, the third spider scuttled frantically around the bottom of the jar, trying to evade Moody's fingers. But he trapped it and placed it upon the desktop. It started to scuttle frantically across the wooden surface. Moody raised his wand, and Harry felt a sudden thrill of foreboding.
"Avada Kedavra!"
Moody roared. There was a flash of blinding green light and a rushing sound, as though a vast, invisible something was soaring through the air. Instantaneously, the spider rolled over onto its back, unmarked, but unmistakably dead. Several of the girls stifled cries. Ron had thrown himself backwards and almost toppled off his seat as the spider skidded towards him. Moody swept the dead spider off the desk onto the floor.
"Not nice," he said calmly. "Not pleasant. And there's no counter-curse. There's no blocking it. Only one known person has ever survived it, and he's sitting right in front of me."
Harry felt his face redden as Moody's eyes, both of them, looked into his own. He could feel everyone else looking around at him too. Harry stared at the blank blackboard as though fascinated by it, but not really seeing it at all. So that was how his parents had died. Exactly like that spider. Had they been unblemished and unmarked too? Had they simply seen the flash of green light and heard the rush of speeding death before life was wiped from their bodies? Harry had been picturing his parents' deaths over and over again for 3 years now, ever since he had found out they had been murdered, ever since he had found out what had happened that night, how Wormtail had betrayed his parents' whereabouts to Voldemort, who had come to find them at their cottage, how Voldemort had killed Harry's father first, how James Potter had tried to hold him off while he shouted at his wife to take Harry and run, and Voldemort had advanced on Lily Potter, told her to move aside so that he could kill Harry, how she had begged him to kill her instead, refused to stop shielding her son, and so Voldemort had murdered her too, before turning his wand on Harry. Harry knew these details because he had heard his parents' voices when he had fought the Dementors last year, for that was the terrible power of the Dementors, to force their victim to relive the worst memories of their life and drown, powerless, in their own despair. Moody was speaking again, from a great distance, it seemed to Harry. With a massive effort, he pulled himself back to the present and listened to what Moody was saying.
"Avada Kedavra's a curse that needs a powerful bit of magic behind it. You could all get your wands out now and point them at me and say the words, and I doubt I'd get so much as a nosebleed. But that doesn't matter. I'm not here to teach you how to do it. Now, if there's no counter-curse, why am I showing you? Because you've got to know. You've got to appreciate what the worst is. You don't want to find yourself in a situation where you're facing it. Constant vigilance! He roared, and the whole class jumped again. Now, those three curses, Avada Kedavra, Imperius, and Cruciatus, are known as the unforgivable curses. The use of any one of them on a fellow human being is enough to earn a life sentence in Azkaban. That's what you're up against. That's what I've got to teach you to fight. You need preparing. You need arming. But most of all, you need to practice constant, never-ceasing vigilance. Get out your quills. Copy this down.
They spent the rest of the lesson taking notes on each of the unforgivable curses. No one spoke until the bell rang. But when Moody had dismissed them and they had left the classroom, a torrent of talk burst forth. Most people were discussing the curses in awed voices.
Did you see it twitch? And when he killed it, just like that!
They were talking about the lesson, Harry thought, as though it had been some sort of spectacular show. But he hadn't found it very entertaining, and nor, it seemed, had Hermione.
Hurry up, she said tensely to Harry and Ron.
Not the ruddy library again, said Ron.
No, said Hermione curtly, pointing up a side passage. Neville?
Neville was standing alone, halfway up the passage, staring at the stone wall opposite him with the same horrified, wide-eyed look he had worn when Moody had demonstrated the Cruciatus curse.
Neville,
Hermione said gently. Neville looked around.
Oh, hello,
he said, his voice much higher than usual.
Interesting lesson, wasn't it? I wonder what's for dinner. I'm starving, aren't you?
Neville, are you all right? Said Hermione.
Oh, yes, I'm fine,
Neville gabbled, in the same unnaturally high voice.
Very interesting dinner, I mean lesson. What's for eating?
Ron gave Harry a startled look.
Neville, what?
But an odd clunking noise sounded behind them, and they turned to see Professor Moody limping towards them. All four of them fell silent, watching him apprehensively. But when he spoke, it was in a much lower and gentler growl than they had yet heard.
"It's all right, sonny," he said to Neville. "Why don't you come up to my office? Come on, we can have a cup of tea."
Neville looked even more frightened at the prospect of tea with Moody. He neither moved nor spoke. Moody turned his magical eye upon Harry.
"You all right, are you, Potter?"
"Yes,"
said Harry, almost defiantly. Moody's blue eye quivered slightly in its socket as it surveyed Harry. Then he said,
"You've got to know. It seems harsh, maybe, but you've got to know. No point pretending. Well, come on, Longbottom. I've got some books that might interest you."
Neville looked pleadingly at Harry, Ron, and Hermione, but they didn't say anything, so Neville had no choice but to allow himself to be steered away, one of Moody's gnarled hands on his shoulder.
"What was that about?"
said Ron, watching Neville and Moody turn the corner.
"I don't know," said Hermione, looking pensive.
"Some lesson, though, eh?" said Ron to Harry, as they set off for the great hall. "Fred and George were right, weren't they? He really knows his stuff, Moody, doesn't he? When he did Avada Kedavra, the way that spider just died, just snuffed it, right?" But Ron fell suddenly silent at the look on Harry's face, and didn't speak again until they reached the great hall, when he said he supposed they had better make a start on Professor Trelawney's predictions tonight, as they would take hours. Hermione did not join in with Harry and Ron's conversation during dinner, but ate furiously fast, and then left for the library again. Harry and Ron walked back to Gryffindor Tower, and Harry, who had been thinking of nothing else all through dinner, now raised the subject of the unforgivable curses himself. "Wouldn't Moody and Dumbledore be in trouble with the Ministry if they knew we'd seen the curses?" Harry asked, as they approached the fat lady.
"Yeah, probably," said Ron. "But Dumbledore's always done things his way, hasn't he? And Moody's been getting into trouble for years, I reckon. Attacks first and asks questions later. Look at his dustbins. Balderdash!"
The fat lady swung forwards to reveal the entrance hole, and they climbed into Gryffindor Common Room, which was crowded and noisy.
"Shall we get our divination stuff, then?" said Harry. I suppose, Ron groaned.
They went up to the dormitory to fetch their books and charts, and found Neville there alone, sitting on his bed, reading. He looked a good deal calmer than at the end of Moody's lesson, though still not entirely normal. His eyes were rather red.
"You all right, Neville?" Harry asked him.
"Oh, yes," said Neville. "I'm fine, thanks. Just reading this book Professor Moody lent me."
He held up the book, Magical Mediterranean Water Plants and Their Properties.
"Apparently, Professor Sprout told Professor Moody I'm really good at herbology," Neville said. There was a faint note of pride in his voice that Harry had rarely heard there before. "He thought I'd like this."
Telling Neville what Professor Sprout had said, Harry thought, had been a very tactful way of cheering Neville up, for Neville very rarely heard that he was good at anything. It was the sort of thing Professor Lupin would have done. Harry and Ron took their copies of Unfogging the Future back down to the common room, found a table, and set to work on their predictions for the coming month. An hour later, they had made very little progress, though their table was littered with bits of parchment bearing sums and symbols, and Harry's brain was as fogged as though it had been filled with the fumes from Professor Trelawney's fire. "I haven't got a clue what this lot's supposed to mean," he said, staring down at a long list of calculations.
"You know," said Ron, whose hair was on end because of all the times he had run his fingers through it in frustration, "I think it's back to the old divination standby."
"What, make it up?"
"Yeah," said Ron, sweeping the jumble of scrawled notes off the table, dipping his pen into some ink, and starting to write.
"Next Monday," he said as he scribbled, "I am likely to develop a cough, owing to the unlucky conjunction of Mars and Jupiter."
He looked up at Harry. "You know her, just put in loads of misery, she'll lap it up."
"Right," said Harry, crumpling up his first attempt and lobbing it over the heads of a group of chattering first years into the fire. "Okay, on Monday I will be in danger of, burns."
"Yeah, you will be," said Ron darkly. "We're seeing the scroots again on Monday.
Okay, Tuesday I'll, lose a treasured possession," said Harry, who was flicking through Unfogging the Future for ideas.
"Good one," said Ron, copying it down.
"Because of, Mercury. Why don't you get stabbed in the back by someone you thought was a friend?"
"Yeah, cool," said Harry, scribbling it down.
"Because Venus is in the 12th house. And on Wednesday, I think I'll come off worst in a fight." "Ah, I was going to have a fight. Okay, I'll lose a bet."
"Yeah, you'll be betting I'll win my fight."
They continued to make up predictions, which grew steadily more tragic, for another hour, while the common room around them slowly emptied as people went up to bed. Crookshanks wandered over to them, leapt lightly into an empty chair, and stared inscrutably at Harry, rather as Hermione might look if she knew they weren't doing their homework properly. Staring around the room, trying to think of a kind of misfortune he hadn't yet used, Harry saw Fred and George sitting together against the opposite wall, heads together, quills out, poring over a single piece of parchment. It was most unusual to see Fred and George hidden away in a corner and working silently. They usually liked to be in the thick of things and the noisy centre of attention. There was something secretive about the way they were working on the piece of parchment, and Harry was reminded of how they had sat together writing something back at the Burrow. He had thought then that it was another order form for Weasley's Wizard Wheezes, but it didn't look like that this time. If it had been, they would surely have let Lee Jordan in on the joke. He wondered whether it had anything to do with entering the Tri-Wizard tournament. As Harry watched, George shook his head at Fred, scratched something out with his quill, and said, in a very quiet voice that nevertheless carried across the almost deserted room,
"No, that sounds like we're accusing him. Got to be careful."
Then George looked over and saw Harry watching him. Harry grinned and quickly returned to his predictions. He didn't want George to think he was eavesdropping. Shortly after that, the twins rolled up their parchment, said good night, and went off to bed. Fred and George had been gone 10 minutes or so when the portrait hole opened,
and Hermione climbed into the common room, carrying a sheaf of parchment in one hand and a box whose contents rattled as she walked in the other. Crookshanks arched his back, purring. "Hello," she said. "I've just finished."
"So have I," said Ron triumphantly, throwing down his quill.
Hermione sat down, laid the thing she was carrying in an empty armchair, and pulled Ron's predictions towards her.
"Not going to have a very good month, are you?" she said sardonically, as Crookshanks curled up in her lap.
"Oh, well, at least I'm forewarned," Ron yawned.
"You seem to be drowning twice," said Hermione.
"Oh, am I?"
said Ron, peering down at his predictions. "I'd better change one of them to getting trampled by a rampaging hippogriff."
"Don't you think it's a bit obvious you've made these up?" said Hermione.
"How dare you!" said Ron in mock outrage. "We've been working like house elves here."
Hermione raised her eyebrows.
"It's just an expression," said Ron hastily.
Harry laid down his quill, too, having just finished predicting his own death by decapitation.
"What's in the box?" he asked, pointing at it.
"Funny you should ask," said Hermione, with a nasty look at Ron. She took off the lid and showed them the contents. Inside were about 50 badges, all of different colours, but all bearing the same letters, S-P-E-W.
"Spew?" said Harry, picking up a badge and looking at it. "What's this about?"
"Not spew," said Hermione impatiently. "It's S-P-E-W. Stands for the Society for the Promotion of Elfish Welfare."
"Never heard of it," said Ron.
"Well, of course you haven't," said Hermione briskly. "I've only just started it."
"Yeah?" said Ron in mild surprise. "How many members have you got?"
"Well, if you two join, 3," said Hermione.
"And you think we want to walk around wearing badges saying spew, do you?" said Ron.
"S-P-E-W," said Hermione hotly. "I was going to put stop the outrageous abuse of our fellow magical creatures and campaign for a change in their legal status, but it wouldn't fit. So that's the heading of our manifesto."
She brandished the sheaf of parchment at them. "I've been researching it thoroughly in the library. Elf enslavement goes back centuries. I can't believe no one's done anything about it before now."
"Hermione, open your ears," said Ron loudly. "They like it. They like being enslaved."
"Our short-term aims," said Hermione, speaking even more loudly than Ron, and acting as though she hadn't heard a word, "are to secure house elves fair wages and working conditions. Our long-term aims include changing the law about non-wand use and trying to get an elf into the Department for the Regulation and Control of Magical Creatures, because they're shockingly underrepresented."
"And how do we do all this?" Harry asked.
"We start by recruiting members," said Hermione happily. "I thought 2 sickles to join, that buys a badge, and the proceeds can fund our leaflet campaign. You're treasurer, Ron. I've got you a collecting tin upstairs. And Harry, you're secretary, so you might want to write down everything I'm saying now as a record of our first meeting."
There was a pause, in which Hermione beamed at the pair of them, and Harry sat, torn between exasperation at Hermione and amusement at the look on Ron's face. The silence was broken not by Ron, who in any case looked as though he was temporarily dumbstruck, but by a soft tap-tap on the window. Harry looked across the now empty common room and saw, illuminated by the moonlight, a snowy owl perched on the windowsill.
"Hedwig!" he shouted, and he launched himself out of his chair and across the room to pull open the window. Hedwig flew inside, soared across the room, and landed on the table on top of Harry's predictions.
"About time," said Harry, hurrying after her.
"She's got an answer," said Ron excitedly, pointing at the grubby piece of parchment tied to Hedwig's leg. Harry hastily untied it and sat down to read it, whereupon Hedwig fluttered onto his knee, hooting softly.
"What does it say?" Hermione asked breathlessly.
The letter was very short, and looked as though it had been scrawled in a great hurry. Harry read it aloud.
"Harry, I'm flying north immediately. This news about your scar is the latest in a series of strange rumours that have reached me here.
If it hurts again, go straight to Dumbledore. They're saying he's got Mad-Eye out of retirement, which means he's reading the signs, even if no one else is. I'll be in touch soon. My best to Ron and Hermione. Keep your eyes open, Harry. Sirius.
Harry looked up at Ron and Hermione, who stared back at him.
"He's flying north," Hermione whispered. "He's coming back."
"Dumbledore's reading what signs?" said Ron, looking perplexed. "Harry, what's up?"
For Harry had just hit himself in the forehead with his fist, jolting Hedwig out of his lap.
"I shouldn't have told him," Harry said furiously. "What are you on about?" said Ron in surprise.
"It's made him think he's got to come back," said Harry,
now slamming his fist on the table so that Hedwig landed on the back of Ron's chair, hooting indignantly. "Coming back because he thinks I'm in trouble, and there's nothing wrong with me. And I haven't got anything for you," Harry snapped at Hedwig, who was clicking her beak expectantly. "You'll have to go up to the owlery if you want food."
Hedwig gave him an extremely offended look and took off for the open window, cuffing him around the head with her outstretched wing as she went.
"Harry," Hermione began, in a pacifying sort of voice.
"I'm going to bed," said Harry shortly. "See you in the morning." Upstairs in the dormitory, he pulled on his pyjamas and got into his four-poster, but he didn't feel remotely tired. If Sirius came back and got caught, it would be his, Harry's, fault. Why hadn't he kept his mouth shut? A few seconds' pain, and he'd had to blab. If he'd just had the sense to keep it to himself. He heard Ron come up into the dormitory a short while later, but did not speak to him. For a long time, Harry lay staring up at the dark canopy of his bed. The dormitory was completely silent, and had he been less preoccupied, Harry would have realized that the absence of Neville's usual snores meant that he was not the only one lying awake.
Chapter 15. Beaubaton and Durmstrang. Early next morning, Harry woke with a plan fully formed in his mind, as though his sleeping brain had been working on it all night. He got up, dressed in the pale dawn light, left the dormitory without waking Ron, and went back down to the deserted common room. Here he took a piece of parchment from the table upon which his divination homework still lay, and wrote the following letter. "Dear Sirius, I reckon I just imagined my scar hurting. I was half asleep when I wrote to you last time. There's no point coming back. Everything's fine here. Don't worry about me. My head feels completely normal. Harry." He then climbed out of the portrait hole, up through the silent castle, held up only briefly by Peeves, who tried to overturn a large vase on him halfway along the fourth-floor corridor, finally arriving at the owlery, which was situated at the top of West Tower. The owlery was a circular stone room, rather cold and draughty, because none of the windows had glass in them. The floor was entirely covered in straw, owl droppings, and the regurgitated skeletons of mice and voles. Hundreds upon hundreds of owls of every breed imaginable were nestled here on perches that rose right up to the top of the tower, nearly all of them asleep, though here and there a round amber eye glared at Harry. He spotted Hedwig nestled between a barn owl and a tawny, and hurried over to her, sliding a little on the dropping-strewn floor. It took him a little while to persuade her to wake up, and then to look at him as she kept shuffling around on her perch, showing him her tail. She was evidently still furious about his lack of gratitude the previous night. In the end, it was Harry suggesting she might be too tired, and that perhaps he would ask Ron to borrow Pigwidgeon, that made her stick out her leg and allow him to tie the letter to it. "Just find him, all right?" Harry said, stroking her back as he carried her on his arm to one of the holes in the wall. "Before the Dementors do." She nipped his finger, perhaps rather harder than she would ordinarily have done, but hooted softly in a reassuring sort of way all the same. Then she spread her wings and took off into the sunrise. Harry watched her out of sight with the familiar feeling of unease back in his stomach. He had been so sure that Sirius' reply would alleviate his worries rather than increasing them.
"That was a lie, Harry," said Hermione sharply over breakfast when he told her and Ron what he had done. "You didn't imagine your scar hurting, and you know it."
"So what?" said Harry. "He's not going back to Azkaban because of me."
"Drop it," said Ron sharply to Hermione, as she opened her mouth to argue some more, and for once Hermione heeded him and fell silent. Harry did his best not to worry about Sirius over the next couple of weeks. True, he could not stop himself looking anxiously around every morning when the post-owls arrived, nor, late at night before he went to sleep, prevent himself seeing horrible visions of Sirius cornered by Dementors down some dark London street. But between times he tried to keep his mind off his godfather. He wished he still had Quidditch to distract him. Nothing worked so well on a troubled mind as a good, hard training session. On the other hand, their lessons were becoming more difficult and demanding than ever before, particularly defence against the dark arts. To their surprise, Professor Moody had announced that he would be putting the Imperius Curse on each of them in turn to demonstrate its power and to see whether they could resist its effects.
But you said it's illegal, Professor, said Hermione uncertainly, as Moody cleared away the desks with a sweep of his wand, leaving a large, clear space in the middle of the room. You said to use it against another human was...
"Dumbledore wants you taught what it feels like," said Moody, his magical eye swivelling onto Hermione and fixing her with an eerie, unblinking stare. "If you'd rather learn the hard way, when someone's putting it on you so they can control you completely, fine by me. You're excused. Off you go."
He pointed one gnarled finger towards the door. Hermione went very pink and muttered something about not meaning that she wanted to leave. Harry and Ron grinned at each other. They knew Hermione would rather eat bubotuber pus than miss such an important lesson. Moody began to beckon students forwards in turn and put the Imperius Curse upon them. Harry watched as, one by one, his classmates did the most extraordinary things under its influence. Dean Thomas hopped three times around the room singing the national anthem. Lavender Brown imitated a squirrel. Neville performed a series of quite astonishing gymnastics he would certainly not have been capable of in his normal state. Not one of them seemed to be able to fight the curse off, and each of them recovered only when Moody had removed it.
"Potter," Moody growled, "you next."
Harry moved forward into the middle of the classroom, into the space that Moody had cleared of desks. Moody raised his wand, pointed it at Harry, and said,
"Imperio!"
It was the most wonderful feeling. Harry felt a floating sensation, as every thought and worry in his head was wiped gently away, leaving nothing but a vague, untraceable happiness. He stood there, feeling immensely relaxed, only dimly aware of everyone watching him. And then he heard Mad-Eye Moody's voice echoing in some distant chamber of his empty brain.
"Jump onto the desk. Jump onto the desk."
Harry bent his knees obediently, preparing to spring.
"Jump onto the desk."
Why, though? Another voice had awoken in the back of his brain. "Stupid thing to do, really," said the voice.
"Jump onto the desk."
"No, I don't think I will, thanks," said the other voice, a little more firmly. "No, I don't really want to."
"Jump now!"
The next thing Harry felt was considerable pain. He had both jumped and tried to prevent himself from jumping. The result was that he had smashed headlong into the desk, knocking it over, and, by the feeling in his legs, fractured both his kneecaps.
"Now that's more like it!"
growled Moody's voice, and suddenly Harry felt the empty, echoing feeling in his head disappear.
He remembered exactly what was happening, and the pain in his knees seemed to double.
"Look at that, you lot! Potter fought! He fought it, and he damn near beat it! We'll try that again, Potter, and the rest of you, pay attention. Watch his eyes. That's where you see it. Very good, Potter. Very good indeed. They'll have trouble controlling you."
"The way he talks," Harry muttered, as he hobbled out of the Defence Against the Dark Arts class an hour later. Moody had insisted on putting Harry through his paces 4 times in a row until Harry could throw the curse off entirely. "You'd think we were all going to be attacked any second." "Yeah, I know," said Ron, who was skipping on every alternate step. He had had much more difficulty with the curse than Harry, though Moody assured him the effects would have worn off by lunchtime. Talk about paranoid. Ron glanced nervously over his shoulder to check that Moody was definitely out of earshot, and went on. "No wonder they were glad to get shot of him at the Ministry. Did you hear him telling Seamus what he did to that witch who shouted boo behind him on April Fool's Day? And when are we supposed to read up on resisting the Imperious Curse with everything else we've got to do?" All the fourth years had noticed a definite increase in the amount of work they were required to do this term. Professor McGonagall explained why, when the class gave a particularly loud groan at the amount of transfiguration homework she had set. "You are now entering a most important phase of your magical education," she told them, her eyes glinting dangerously behind her square spectacles. "Your ordinary wizarding levels are drawing closer." "We don't take OWLs till 5th year, said Dean Thomas indignantly. "Maybe not, Thomas, but believe me, you'll need all the preparation you can get. Miss Granger remains the only person in this class who has managed to turn a hedgehog into a satisfactory pincushion. I might remind you that your pincushion, Thomas, still curls up in fright if anyone approaches it with a pin." Hermione, who had turned rather pink again, seemed to be trying not to look too pleased with herself. Harry and Ron were deeply amused when Professor Trelawney told them that they had received top marks for their homework in their next divination class. She read out large portions of their predictions, commending them for their unflinching acceptance of the horrors in store for them. But they were less amused when she asked them to do the same thing for the month after next. Both of them were running out of ideas for catastrophes. Meanwhile, Professor Binns, the ghost who taught history of magic, had them writing weekly essays on the goblin rebellions of the 18th century. Professor Snape was forcing them to research antidotes. They took this seriously, as he had hinted that he might be poisoning one of them before Christmas to see if their antidote worked. Professor Flitwick had asked them to read 3 extra books in preparation for their lesson on summoning charms. Even Hagrid was adding to their workload. The blast-ended scroots were growing at a remarkable pace, given that nobody had yet discovered what they ate. Hagrid was delighted and, as part of their project, suggested that they come down to his hut on alternate evenings to observe the scroots and make notes on their extraordinary behaviour. "I will not," said Draco Malfoy flatly, when Hagrid had proposed this, with the air of Father Christmas pulling an extra-large toy out of his sack. "I see enough of these foul things during lessons, thanks." Hagrid's smile faded from his face. "You'll do what you're told," he growled, "or I'll be taking a leaf out of Professor Moody's book. I hear you made a good ferret, Malfoy." The Gryffindors roared with laughter. Malfoy flushed with anger, but apparently the memory of Moody's punishment was still sufficiently painful to stop him retorting. Harry, Ron, and Hermione returned to the castle at the end of the lesson in high spirits. Seeing Hagrid put down Malfoy was particularly satisfying, especially because Malfoy had done his very best to get Hagrid sacked the previous year. When they arrived in the entrance hall, they found themselves unable to proceed, owing to the large crowd of students congregated there, all milling around a large sign which had been erected at the foot of the marble staircase. Ron, the tallest of the three, stood on tiptoe to see over the heads in front of them and read the sign aloud to the other two. "Triwizard Tournament. The delegations from Beauxbatons and Durmstrang will be arriving at 6 o'clock on Friday, 30th of October. Lessons will end 30 minutes early. "Brilliant," said Harry. "It's potions lasting on Friday. Snape won't have time to poison us all. Students will return their bags and books to their dormitories and assemble in front of the castle to greet our guests before the welcoming feast." "Only a week away," said Ernie Macmillan of Hufflepuff, emerging from the crowds, his eyes gleaming. "I wonder if Cedric knows. Think I'll go and tell him."
"Cedric?" said Ron blankly, as Ernie hurried off.
"Diggory," said Harry. "He must be entering the tournament."
"That idiot, Hogwarts champion," said Ron, as they pushed their way through the chattering crowd towards the staircase.
"He's not an idiot. You just don't like him because he beat Gryffindor at Quidditch," said Hermione. "I've heard he's a really good student, and he's a prefect." She spoke as though this settled the matter.
"You only like him because he's handsome," said Ron scathingly.
"Excuse me, I don't like people just because they're handsome," said Hermione indignantly.
Ron gave a loud, false cough, which sounded oddly like
Lockhart.
The appearance of the sign in the entrance hall had a marked effect upon the inhabitants of the castle. During the following week, there seemed to be only one topic of conversation, no matter where Harry went, the Tri-Wizard Tournament. Rumours were flying from student to student like highly contagious germs. Who was going to try for Hogwarts champion? What the tournament would involve? How the students from Beauxbatons and Durmstrang differed from themselves? Harry noticed, too, that the castle seemed to be undergoing an extra thorough cleaning. Several grimy portraits had been scrubbed, much to the displeasure of their subjects, who sat huddled in their frames, muttering darkly and wincing as they felt their raw pink faces. The suits of armour were suddenly gleaming and moving without squeaking, and Argus Filch, the caretaker, was behaving so ferociously to any student who forgot to wipe their shoes that he terrified a pair of first-year girls into hysterics. Other members of staff seemed oddly tense, too.
"Longbottom, kindly do not reveal that you can't even perform a simple switching spell in front of anyone from Durmstrang,"
Professor McGonagall barked at the end of one particularly difficult lesson, during which Neville had accidentally transplanted his own ears onto a cactus.
When they went down to breakfast on the morning of the 30th of October, they found that the great hall had been decorated overnight. Enormous silk banners hung from the walls, each of them representing a Hogwarts house, red with a gold lion for Gryffindor, blue with a bronze eagle for Ravenclaw, yellow with a black badger for Hufflepuff, and green with a silver serpent for Slytherin. Behind the teacher's table, the largest banner of all bore the Hogwarts coat of arms, lion, eagle, badger, and snake united around a large letter H. Harry, Ron and Hermione spotted Fred and George at the Gryffindor table. Once again, and most unusually, they were sitting apart from everyone else and conversing in low voices. Ron led the way over to them.
"It's a bummer, all right," George was saying gloomily to Fred.
"But if he won't talk to us in person, we'll have to send him the letter after all. Or we'll stuff it into his hand. He can't avoid us forever."
"Who's avoiding you?" said Ron, sitting down next to them.
"Wish you would," said Fred, looking irritated at the interruption.
"What's a bummer?" Ron asked George.
"Having a nosy git like you for a brother," said George.
"You two got any ideas on the Tri-Wizard Tournament yet?" Harry asked. "Thought any more about trying to enter?"
"I asked McGonagall how the champions are chosen, but she wasn't telling," said George bitterly. "She just told me to shut up and get on with transfiguring my raccoon."
"Wonder what the tasks are going to be," said Ron thoughtfully. "You know, I bet we could do them, Harry. We've done dangerous stuff before."
"Not in front of a panel of judges, you haven't," said Fred.
"McGonagall says the champions get awarded points according to how well they've done the tasks."
"Who are the judges?" Harry asked.
"Well, the heads of the participating schools are always on the panel," said Hermione, and everyone looked around at her, rather surprised, "because all three of them were injured during the tournament of 1792, when a cockatrice the champions were supposed to be catching went on the rampage."
She noticed them all looking at her, and said, with her usual air of impatience, that nobody else had read all the books she had. "It's all in Hogwarts, A History, though, of course, that book's not entirely reliable. A revised history of Hogwarts would be a more accurate title, or a highly biased and selective history of Hogwarts, which glosses over the nastier aspects of the school." "What are you on about?" said Ron, though Harry thought he knew what was coming. "House elves," said Hermione loudly, and proving Harry right. "Not once in over 1,000 pages does Hogwarts, A History, mention that we are all colluding in the oppression of 100 slaves." Harry shook his head and applied himself to his scrambled eggs. His and Ron's lack of enthusiasm had done nothing whatsoever to curb Hermione's determination to pursue justice for house elves. True, both of them had paid 2 sickles for an SPEW badge, but they had only done it to keep her quiet. Their sickles had been wasted, however. If anything, they seemed to have made Hermione more vociferous. She had been badgering Harry and Ron ever since, firstly to wear the badges, then to persuade others to do the same. And she had also taken to rattling around the Gryffindor common room every evening, cornering people and shaking the collecting tin under their noses. "You do realize that your sheets are changed, your fires lit, your classrooms cleaned, and your food cooked by a group of magical creatures who are unpaid and enslaved?" she kept saying fiercely. Some people, like Neville, had paid up just to stop Hermione glowering at them. A few seemed mildly interested in what she had to say, but were reluctant to take a more active role in campaigning. Many regarded the whole thing as a joke. Ron now rolled his eyes at the ceiling, which was flooding them all in autumn sunlight, and Fred became extremely interested in his bacon. Both twins had refused to buy an SPEW badge. George, however, leant towards Hermione. "Listen, have you ever been down in the kitchens, Hermione?" "No, of course not," said Hermione curtly. "I hardly think students are supposed to..." "Well, we have," said George, indicating Fred. "Loads of times, to nick food. And we've met them, and they're happy. They think they've got the best job in the world." "That's because they're uneducated and brainwashed," Hermione began hotly. But her next few words were drowned by the sudden whooshing noise from overhead, which announced the arrival of the post-owls. Harry looked up at once and saw Hedwig soaring towards him. Hermione stopped talking abruptly. She and Ron watched Hedwig anxiously as she fluttered down onto Harry's shoulder, folded her wings, and held out her leg wearily. Harry pulled off Sirius' reply and offered Hedwig his bacon rinds, which she ate gratefully. Then, checking that Fred and George were safely immersed in further discussions about the Tri-Wizard tournament, Harry read out Sirius' letter in a whisper to Ron and Hermione. "Nice try, Harry. I'm back in the country and well hidden. I want you to keep me posted on everything that's going on at Hogwarts. Don't use Hedwig. Keep changing owls. And don't worry about me. Just watch out for yourself. Don't forget what I said about your scar. Sirius." "Why do you have to keep changing owls?" Ron asked in a low voice. "Hedwig'll attract too much attention," said Hermione at once. "She stands out, a snowy owl that keeps returning to wherever he's hiding. I mean, they're not native birds, are they?" Harry rolled up the letter and slipped it inside his robes, wondering whether he felt more or less worried than before. He supposed that Sirius managing to get back without being caught was something. He couldn't deny, either, that the idea that Sirius was much nearer was reassuring. At least he wouldn't have to wait so long for a response every time he wrote. "Thanks, Hedwig," he said, stroking her. She hooted sleepily, dipped her beak briefly into his goblet of orange juice, then took off again, clearly desperate for a good long sleep in the owlery. There was a pleasant feeling of anticipation in the air that day. Nobody was very attentive in lessons, being much more interested in the arrival that evening of the people from Beauxbatons and Durmstrang. Even potions was more bearable than usual, as it was half an hour shorter. When the bell rang early,
Harry, Ron and Hermione hurried up to Gryffindor Tower, deposited their bags and books as they had been instructed, pulled on their cloaks, and rushed back downstairs into the entrance hall. The heads of houses were ordering their students into lines.
"Weasley, straighten your hat!" Professor McGonagall snapped at Ron. "Miss Patil, take that ridiculous thing out of your hair!"
Parvati scowled and removed a large ornamental butterfly from the end of her plait.
"Follow me, please," said Professor McGonagall. "First years in front, no pushing."
They filed down the front steps and lined up in front of the castle. It was a cold, clear evening. Dusk was falling, and a pale, transparent-looking moon was already shining over the Forbidden Forest. Harry, standing between Ron and Hermione in the fourth row from the front, saw Dennis Creevy positively shivering with anticipation among the other first years.
"Nearly six," said Ron, checking his watch and then staring down the drive which led to the front gates.
"How do you reckon they're coming? The train?"
"I doubt it," said Hermione.
"How then? Broomsticks?" Harry suggested, looking up at the starry sky.
"I don't think so. Not from that far away."
"A portkey," Ron suggested. "Or they could apparate. Maybe you're allowed to do it under 17, wherever they come from."
"You can't apparate inside the Hogwarts grounds. How often do I have to tell you?" said Hermione impatiently.
They scanned the darkening grounds excitedly, but nothing was moving. Everything was still, silent, and quite as usual. Harry was starting to feel cold. He wished they'd hurry up. Maybe the foreign students were preparing a dramatic entrance. He remembered what Mr. Weasley had said back on the campsite before the Quidditch World Cup. "Always the same, we can't resist showing off when we get together." And then Dumbledore called out from the back row, where he stood with the other teachers.
"Aha! Unless I'm very much mistaken, the delegation from Beauxbatons approaches."
"Where?"
said many students eagerly, all looking in different directions.
"There!"
yelled a sixth year, pointing over the forest. Something large, much larger than a broomstick, or indeed 100 broomsticks, was hurtling across the deep blue sky towards the castle, growing larger all the time.
"It's a dragon!"
shrieked one of the first years, losing her head completely.
"Don't be stupid! It's a flying house!" said Dennis Creevy.
Dennis's guess was closer. As the gigantic black shape skimmed over the treetops of the Forbidden Forest and the lights shining from the castle windows hit it, they saw a gigantic, powder-blue, horse-drawn carriage, the size of a large house, soaring towards them, pulled through the air by a dozen winged horses, all palominos, and each the size of an elephant. The front three rows of students drew backwards as the carriage hurtled ever lower, coming in to land at a tremendous speed. Then, with an almighty crash that made Neville jump backwards onto a Slytherin fifth year's foot, the horses' hooves, larger than dinner plates, hit the ground. A second later, the carriage landed too, bouncing upon its vast wheels, while the golden horses tossed their enormous heads and rolled large, fiery red eyes. Harry just had time to see that the door of the carriage bore a coat of arms, two crossed golden wands, each emitting three stars, before it opened. A boy in pale blue robes jumped down from the carriage, bent forwards, fumbled for a moment with something on the carriage floor, and unfolded a set of golden steps. He sprang back respectfully. Then Harry saw a shining, high-heeled black shoe emerging from the inside of the carriage, a shoe the size of a child's sled, followed almost immediately by the largest woman he had ever seen in his life. The size of the carriage and of the horses was immediately explained. A few people gasped. Harry had only ever seen one person as large as this woman in his life, and that was Hagrid. He doubted whether there was an inch difference in their heights. Yet somehow, maybe simply because he was used to Hagrid, this woman, now at the foot of the steps and looking around at the waiting, wide-eyed crowd,
seemed even more unnaturally large. As she stepped into the light flooding from the entrance hall, she was revealed to have a handsome, olive-skinned face, large, black, liquid-looking eyes, and a rather beaky nose. Her hair was drawn back in a shining knob at the base of her neck. She was dressed from head to foot in black satin, and many magnificent opals gleamed at her throat and on her thick fingers. Dumbledore started to clap. The students, following his lead, broke into applause too, many of them standing on tiptoe, the better to look at this woman. Her face relaxed into a gracious smile, and she walked forwards towards Dumbledore, extending a glittering hand. Dumbledore, though tall himself, had barely to bend to kiss it. "My dear Madame Maxime," he said, "welcome to Hogwarts." "Dumbledore," said Madame Maxime in a deep voice, "I hope I find you well."
"On excellent form, I thank you," said Dumbledore.
"My pupils," said Madame Maxime, waving one of her enormous hands carelessly behind her. Harry, whose attention had been focused completely upon Madame Maxime, now noticed that around a dozen boys and girls, all, by the look of them, in their late teens, had emerged from the carriage and were now standing behind Madame Maxime. They were shivering, which was unsurprising, given that their robes seemed to be made of fine silk, and none of them were wearing cloaks. A few of them had wrapped scarves and shawls around their heads. From what Harry could see of their faces, they were standing in Madame Maxime's enormous shadow, they were staring up at Hogwarts with apprehensive looks on their faces.
"Has Karkaroff arrived yet?" Madame Maxime asked. "He should be here any moment," said Dumbledore. "Would you like to wait here and greet him, or would you prefer to step inside and warm up a trifle?"
"Warm up, I think," said Madame Maxime.
"But the horses—" "Our care of magical creatures, teacher, will be delighted to take care of them," said Dumbledore, "the moment he has returned from dealing with a slight situation which has arisen with some of his other, charges."
"Scroots," Ron muttered to Harry, grinning.
"My steeds require, forceful handling," said Madame Maxime, looking as though she doubted whether any care of magical creatures teacher at Hogwarts could be up to the job. "They are very strong."
"I assure you that Hagrid will be well up to the job," said Dumbledore, smiling.
"Very well," said Madame Maxime, bowing slightly. "Will you please inform this Hagrid that the horses drink only single malt whisky?"
"It will be attended to," said Dumbledore, also bowing.
"Come," said Madame Maxime imperiously to her students, and the Hogwarts crowd parted to allow her and her students to pass up the stone steps.
"How big do you reckon Durmstrang's horses are going to be?" Seamus Finnegan said, leaning around Lavender and Parvati to address Harry and Ron.
"Well, if they're any bigger than this lot, even Hagrid won't be able to handle them," said Harry. "That's if he hasn't been attacked by his Scroots. Wonder what's up with them."
"Maybe they've escaped," said Ron, hopefully.
"Oh, don't say that," said Hermione, with a shudder. "Imagine that lot loose in the grounds."
They stood, shivering slightly now, waiting for the Durmstrang party to arrive. Most people were gazing hopefully up at the sky. For a few minutes the silence was broken only by Madame Maxime's huge horses snorting and stamping, but then—
"Can you hear something?" said Ron suddenly.
Harry listened. A loud and oddly eerie noise was drifting towards them from out of the darkness, a muffled rumbling and sucking sound, as though an immense vacuum cleaner was moving along a river bed.
"The lake!" yelled Lee Jordan, pointing down at it. "Look at the lake!"
From their position at the top of the lawns overlooking the grounds, they had a clear view of the smooth black surface of the water, except that the surface was suddenly not smooth at all. Some disturbance was taking place deep in the centre. Great bubbles were forming on the surface. Waves were now washing over the muddy banks. And then, out in the very middle of the lake, a whirlpool appeared, as if a giant plug had just been pulled out of the lake's floor.
what seemed to be a long, black pole began to rise slowly out of the heart of the whirlpool, and then Harry saw the rigging. "It's a mast," he said to Ron and Hermione. Slowly, magnificently, the ship rose out of the water, gleaming in the moonlight. It had a strangely skeletal look about it, as though it was a resurrected wreck, and the dim, misty lights shimmering at its portholes looked like ghostly eyes. Finally, with a great sloshing noise, the ship emerged entirely, bobbing on the turbulent water, and began to glide towards the bank. A few moments later, they heard the splash of an anchor being thrown down in the shallows and the thud of a plank being lowered onto the bank. People were disembarking. They could see their silhouettes passing the lights in the ship's portholes. All of them, Harry noticed, seemed to be built along the lines of Crabbe and Goyle. But then, as they drew nearer, walking up the lawns into the light streaming from the entrance hall, he saw that their bulk was really due to the fact that they were wearing cloaks of some kind of shaggy, matted fur. But the man who was leading them up to the castle was wearing furs of a different sort, sleek and silver, like his hair.
"Dumbledore!" he called heartily as he walked up the slope. "How are you, my dear fellow? How are you?"
"Blooming, thank you, Professor Karkaroff," Dumbledore replied.
Karkaroff had a fruity, unctuous voice. When he stepped into the light pouring from the front doors of the castle, they saw that he was tall and thin like Dumbledore, but his white hair was short, and his goatee, finishing in a small curl, did not entirely hide his rather weak chin. When he reached Dumbledore, he shook hands with both of his own.
"Dear old Hogwarts," he said, looking up at the castle and smiling.
His teeth were rather yellow, and Harry noticed that his smile did not extend to his eyes, which remained cold and shrewd.
"How good it is to be here! How good! Victor, come along into the warmth. You don't mind, Dumbledore. Victor has a slight head cold."
Karkaroff beckoned forwards one of his students. As the boy passed, Harry caught a glimpse of a prominent curved nose and thick black eyebrows. He didn't need the punch on the arm Ron gave him or the hiss in his ear to recognize that profile.
"Harry, it's Crumb!"